Okay, we're going to continue with the fifth article. In the Solemn and Covenant, the ordinance of covenanting. We'll call attention again to the fourth term of communion, that public social covenanting is an ordinance of God, obligatory on churches and nations under the New Testament, that the national covenant and the solemn league are an exemplification of this divine institution, and that these deeds are of continued obligation upon the moral person. The fifth article reads, "And whereas the happiness of a blessed peace between these kingdoms, denied in former times to our progenitors, is by the good providence of God granted unto us, and hath been lately concluded and settled by both parliaments, we shall each one of us, according to our place and interest, endeavor that they may remain conjoined in a firm peace and union to all posterity, and that justice may be done upon the willful opposers thereof in manner expressed in the precedent article." So if you remember in the precedent article, they were concerned to bring to condign punishment any and all people who were going to oppose the union, both the religious covenant and the civil league between the three nations or three kingdoms. They were concerned to see that these three kingdoms remained in that state of religious and civil union and in communion. They were concerned that nothing would be allowed to arise either on the political front or on the religious front. They were concerned, for example, to see the Church of England reformed. And that's really, the Solemn League is why the Westminster Assembly is being called. They want religious uniformity between the three nations. And they want to bring about a more effective cooperation between the three kingdoms, because they already have a union of crown. The House of Stuart is ruling at this time. They're ruling in Scotland. They're, in fact, James was first, James the Sixth of Scotland, before he became James the First of England. And in his person, he was the king of both kingdoms, but they were considered two separate kingdoms. This covenant is trying to bring things together and effect, under Charles the First, effect a better basis for union and peace with the Parliament, between the Parliament and the king in particular. So they've made great promises to the king. They've promised their support to the king so long as he's reformed and reforming. They've promised support in any kind of political endeavor that's going to help facilitate enacting these articles of the Solemn League and Covenant. They have not promised a unilateral letting down of their principles in order to support. In other words, they want to make sure that the king is going to support the true religion, that it's going to have a certain religious connotation in England in particular. They want to make sure that the people on both sides of that border, between England and Scotland, as well as those in Ireland, are aware that they're committed to a particular course of action. and that the action is being driven by a desire for nearness and uniformity in religion. The English desire for help in terms of military league, a civil league, is predicated upon the Scottish insistence on a religious covenant. So entering into this, they're trying to correct various problems that they perceive in church and state, particularly in England, but they're not unaware of weaknesses on the Scottish side as well. The Scots certainly had a different view of monarchy than the English. And this Solemn League and Covenant is really pushing the Scots to have a little bit higher view, a little bit more respect for the monarchy, in exchange for the monarch becoming more concerned about the true Reformed religion. So it's not all one-sided here, as sometimes people would like to portray it. The monarch in Scotland has a very different task before him than the monarch in England. The monarch in Scotland really was a more of an exalted nobleman that had to keep the respect of a bunch of noble houses and rule with a bit more of their consent. England didn't have quite that view. Although since the time of King John and the Magna Carta, there had been a push in England for the support, the consent of the governed. The monarch in England had more power. The monarch in England could do more without consulting either Parliament or people. In Scotland, what would have been handled in the Parliament was handled more amongst the nobility. So there's a give and there's a take on both sides in this Solemn League. The Scots are being pushed to become a little bit more coherent in their political philosophy. The English are being challenged to be more reformed in their church, their national church, and that the magistrate would uphold that. So when they talk then about the blessed peace between the kingdoms denied in former times by the good providence of God and now granted, they are talking about, and there were real rivalries and there were real differences between the Scots and the English. They had different traditions. They had different views of the monarchy. They had different views of how the people, although both by this time would have wanted the consent of the governed, they have different views on how that consent is going to be displayed. The Scottish Parliament is not nearly the political engine in Scotland that the English Parliament is in England. The English Parliament is very clearly the representatives of the people, particularly the Commons, and it's very clearly responsive to the people. Scotland, they're still a little bit more backward in terms of modern democratic ideals or republican government than the English on that particular point. Their parliament is more of a hodgepodge of nobility that are scattered all over the different shires. So there are differences, to be sure, and those differences led to different fights and hostilities between the English and the Scots. And this hostility is going to continue. Despite the Solemn League, this hostility is going to continue for decades. The king is going to send troops into Scotland again and again and again. And the Scots are going to come over the border into England again and again and again, particularly in the later 1640s, 1650s, and then there are going to be a number of skirmishes during what we call the Killing Times that ultimately are rooted, at least in part, in this fight, this continual hostility. They occupy the same island, but the Scots are actually more closely aligned early on with the French. And that presents a problem. When they want reinforcements, they very often are calling on the French to help them prior to this period of time. So they're referring to that. There are all kinds. There's a history, a very long history of issues. And a lot of these issues are going away because Elizabeth reached out and on her deathbed chose James to be her successor. But that doesn't fix every problem, and it presumes that James is going to rule in England like he did in Scotland, which he doesn't, because he's got more power when he moves to England. There are more things that he can do. So they're talking about this peace. It's a good thing. They want to keep it. They want to extend it. In addition to that, they point to the fact that both parliaments have been involved. And that's a way of acknowledging both that this is a desire of the people, expressed through their lawful governments. It's also, I think, a comment, as we'll see, on what they think the concern of a civil government ought to be. They go on to talk about how this is really a concern. They want to work at this peace and retaining this peace, not simply for themselves, but for their posterity. So again, they're looking at what they're doing as a work that's going to transcend the generations. They don't simply view what they're doing as something limited to their time and place, but as something upon which they hope that all of their posterity will find something to profit. And finally, they do go back to that point about looking for justice for people who oppose it. Why? Well, they're concerned. They're concerned because anybody who's going to oppose this is going to oppose it. They're opposing not only what they're doing then, but they're opposing what they view, again, as a generational work. They're setting themselves in opposition to what the Covenanters here would see as the course of history. Eventually, the true religion is going to win out. They know that. It may take time. It may involve a lot of setbacks. But the people who are entering into the covenant are certain that however long it takes and however many setbacks there are, that their cause is going to prevail. So people who are going to oppose it, they ought to be sought out and marginalized by way of punishment or banishment, whatever needs to be done, so they don't stand in the way of what they're trying to accomplish here. So we'll look at some of the questions that they raised in terms of what Scripture has to say with regard to their concerns in this fifth article. Question one. Is it a great blessing for diverse kingdoms and nations to be at peace? The answer is yes. We want to look at Isaiah 2:4.
Isaiah 2, verse 4. And he shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore.
Isaiah is talking about the gospel era, the time of Messiah, and it's a time that will be characterized by peace. Where Christ reigns, there's peace. Where he's not reigning, there's war. And so if he's reigning in the kingdoms, then there ought to be, the effect of that ought to be peace. There shouldn't be a lot of war. So it's a great blessing. We need to see what they're saying here, not in terms of peace. You know, we tend to think of peace in civil, just in purely civil terms. That peace is something that benefits us as a nation. And it's really almost purely a civil concern. They didn't view it that way. They viewed civil peace as the outcome, the proper state of a nation which, in fact, was in submission to the gospel. So when they're talking about peace, the great blessing is that this has been brought about by true religion. But to the extent that they're getting together, why? They're pursuing Christianity, real biblical Christianity. Right? Peace being the fruit of kingdoms and nations establishing the true religion in liberties of the subjects constitutes a crowning blessing upon such as achieve it. Look at Jeremiah 34:4-8.
Jeremiah 34:4-8. Yet hear the word of the Lord, O Zedekiah, king of Judah. Thus saith the Lord of thee, thou shalt not die by the sword, but thou shalt die in peace, and with the burnings of thy fathers, the former kings which were before thee. So shall they burn odors for thee, and they will lament thee, saying, Ah, Lord, for I have pronounced the word, saith the Lord. Then Jeremiah the prophet spake all these things unto Zedekiah, king of Judah, in Jerusalem, when the king of Babylon's army fought against Jerusalem and against all the cities of Judah that were left, against Lachish and against Azekah, and for these defensed cities remained of the cities of Judah. This is the word that came unto Jeremiah from the Lord. After that, the king Zedekiah had made a covenant with all the people which were at Jerusalem to proclaim liberty unto them.
This is a more important point. When I sketched out the history, I didn't mean to give a detailed history in giving an overview. It's very easy for things to be missed. It's very easy to get the wrong impression about what things were like at that time. I really want you just to remember that these were not two kingdoms that thought exactly alike about everything, although they had things in common, and that they were concerned that any kind of civil union, civil league, that was going to be centered around a concern for religious uniformity. That there was going to be that religious covenant at the center of that civil league. That's why it's such a blessing to the people who are covenanting. See that this is going on, that there's this peace coming about that hadn't been there before. What's driving it? What's moving it? It's not just tribalism, because they understand and they acknowledge that prior to this, they really were not at a point of peace. There had been conflict. they see their agenda as the proper international peace project of the day. They can't even begin to comprehend what has become a very commonplace view in the 20th and 21st centuries, this idea of nations being at peace by not having an eye to religious difference, by putting that over in a compartment and dealing with one another on a purely political basis. They view the political basis as being sustainable only on a religious one. And so for all the people who think that religious wars are bad, they ought to keep in mind that the worst wars in human history have come out of a thinking that was based not on this idea of alliance by religious covenant, but upon an idea that comes out of the end of the 30 Years' War and really comes into prominence after 1650, which is known as the balance of power. That became the ruling model, and to some extent is still the ruling model, but it became the ruling model for how Europe would function right up until the First World War, when it really went to pieces. And nobody can have all the power. Can't have all the power pieces in one country. You have to have at least two countries in a sort of a standoff to make sure that nobody wants to go to war. You know, we lived most of the 20th century with that view intact, that there needed to be two powers that could kind of wipe themselves off the face of the earth, and that and world peace was predicated upon keeping those two powers sort of in equilibrium. So we want to make sure they have the same stockpile of weapons, you know, the same kind of access to technologies and so on. The English and the Scots who are covenanting are not thinking that way at all. They understand the problem fundamentally is a religious one, that if there's a common religion, tribal differences are going to pale in comparison between English and Scots, or with respect to the Irish, for that matter. All right. When the Lord is pleased to bless his people to dwell in safety, there's an accompanying peace with it. Look at Psalm 4:8.
Psalm 4, verse 8. I will both lay me down in peace and sleep, for thou, Lord, only makest me dwell in safety.
Conversely, it's a false and conniving peace that the wicked promise upon them unto themselves. 2 Samuel 17:3.
2 Samuel 17, verse 3. Then I will bring back all the people unto thee, the man whom thou seekest, is as if all returned, so all the people shall be in peace.
It's not a real peace that they're promising. It's a conniving at peace. Behind the scenes, they're for war. And one reason we've been plagued with so many wars is that they have never really addressed the basis for lasting peace. It's not economic. It's not political. It's religious. And the covenanters knew that. They understood that. And that's why they're concerned not only to see it established, but to see it perpetuated. Now, that raises a question. Should it be a concern of governments to establish peace? And the answer is yes. Look at Jeremiah 29:7.
Jeremiah 29:7. And seek the peace of the city, whether I have called you to be carried away captives, and pray unto the Lord for it. For in the peace thereof shall ye have peace.
Yeah, this is not an odd thing. We know that the peace of the Lord's people is bound up with the peace of those governments under which they find themselves. And Paul tells us to pray to that end. 1 Timothy 2:1-4.
1 Timothy 2:1-4. I exhort therefore that first of all supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men,
for kings and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. For this is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, who will have all men to be saved and to come unto the knowledge of the truth.
If we're praying for the peace of the society, ultimately, Paul tells us we have to pray for the conversion of the society, that the magistrate's going to do his job. We can live our lives in all godliness and honesty. We can live in terms of our duty to God and our duty to man. And that means an enforcing of all 10 commandments. That's what brings about a social or civil peace. That's precisely why we understand that apart from God working effectually in and through people, they're not going to keep those commandments. That's why a lasting peace can only be had when nations have, in fact, adopted and conformed themselves to the true religion. Magistrates establish peace through an enforcement of justice, without which the rulers themselves become the objects of scorn. Look at Proverbs 24, 23 and 24.
Proverbs 24, verses 23 and 24. These things also belong to the wise. It is not good to have respect of persons in judgment. He that saith unto the wicked, thou art righteous, him shall the people curse, nations shall abhor him.
Proverbs tells us that the magistrate ought to enforce an impartial justice. If they fail to uphold the commandments of God, they become a matter of scorn. You can look at what's going on around and ask, if we ask why is it people have so little respect for the government, it's not because they're not enacting laws, it's because they're not enacting laws impartially that are just laws according to and conform to the Ten Commandments. Even the wicked gain a certain amount of respect for governments that function that way. They're not going to be able to behave in an unruly way. They're not going to be able to undermine the end of the government, and therefore there's going to be a certain amount of peace in that society. When the wicked are brought to condign punishment, that brings peace to those who are in fact resolved to live according to the commandments of God. When the magistrate doesn't do that, the magistrate really shows himself to be unequal to the task, and therefore they tend to become a scorn. Now remember that this is only going to be possible. You're only going to have two or more nations meeting eye to eye when they share the same religious commitment, when they share the same take on those commands. You know, if they don't have a proper view, there's not going to be a point at which they can meet. Right. Enforcement of justice then demands a proper estimate of what is good and what is not good. Look at Proverbs 18:5.
Proverbs 18:5. It is not good to accept the person of the wicked to overthrow the righteous in judgment.
Yeah, they shouldn't be accepting the person of the wicked. Well, how do we know who that is? And this is part of the problem. When they accept the person of the wicked, they are overthrowing the righteous in some respect or other. You can't enforce a law without penalizing someone. If your law isn't, in fact, according to the commandments of God, then you're really running the risk of penalizing those who are righteous. You're rewarding the wicked, but you're punishing the righteous. Because the righteous can't acquiesce in that. They can't say that's okay. It'll never be okay. No matter how much propaganda they put out there, it's never going to be acceptable. So governments have to be concerned to establish peace. The covenanters are right in that. They ought to be very concerned to see that that peace that they're establishing not only prevails, but is perpetuated. They knew it was, in Solomon's day, it was a characteristic of his kingdom that it was both unified and at peace. Look at 1 Kings 4, 24 and 25.
1 Kings 4, verses 24 and 25. For he had dominion over all the region on this side of the river, from Tiphsa even to Azza, over all the kings on this side of the river. And he had peace on all sides round about him. And Judah and Israel dwelt safely, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, from Dan even to Beersheba, all the days of Solomon.
Why did Solomon have that kind of unity and peace? He sought it not by political means. He didn't seek it by economic treaty. It was first of all a unity of religion, religious sentiment, and that brought about a universal peace. Wherever you go in the world, if you find places where they're of the same religion and the law is being enforced with a certain amount of impartiality, you're going to find peace there. Now, it's not going to be a proper peace if it's not the true religion. But you're going to find a degree of peace there that you're not going to find anywhere else in the world. Which is why Islam looks so good to so much of the world that's struggling to find peace. Christian nations have failed miserably in this regard. And have shown themselves to be bad examples, miserably in this regard. So, if it's a government's concern, if its parliament has a right and a duty to be seeking this peace, if they're seeing it a great blessing, the third question then is, ought we to endeavor the keeping of such peace unto all posterity? The answer is yes. We want to look at Psalm 122, verses 6 to 8.
Psalm 122, verses 6 to 8. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. They shall prosper. They shall prosper that love thee. Peace be within thy walls, and prosperity within thy palaces. For my brethren and companions' sake, I will now say, peace be within thee.
It is a characteristic of the Church of God to be the center of peace. It's that for which we ought to pray, and it's that which we ought also to endeavor to keep. If we're supposed to be praying for peace, we should be endeavoring to keep it. And keeping it means, first and foremost, keeping the true religion. Can't have peace apart from the true religion. You start stepping outside of that, and you're introducing war. The wars that we've suffered, the wars that we see, are not the result of religion. It's the result of departing from religion. It's the result of nations which are in the process, at a greater or lesser speed, of casting away the faith of their fathers. Now, if we consider that it's the duty of good men to leave behind an inheritance for their children, and it is, look at Proverbs 13:22.
Proverbs 13:22. A good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children, and the wealth of the sinner is laid up for the just.
And in fact, they maintain that yet is theirs to give or withhold by title. Look at Matthew 7:9-11.
Matthew 7, verses 9-11. What man is there of you whom if his son ask bread, will he give him a stone? Or if he ask a fish, will he give him a serpent? If ye then, being evil, know how to give good gifts unto your children, how much more shall your Father which is in heaven give good things to them that ask him?
Again, if we consider that those verses are really talking about property and leaving behind property, how much more are good men obliged to keep such a peace unto posterity, which they possess not as property, but by right? We have a right to peace. We have a right to that. We're depriving our posterity of peace when we deprive them of the true religion. We're depriving our posterity of peace when we fail to study and follow through with the Christian faith. Now, we have a right with our property to give or withhold from our posterity what we think is going to be good for them. But we don't have that right when it comes to something so foundational, so fundamental as peace. We don't have a right to bequeath a world filled with war and turmoil. But the only way to avoid that is to study to do what these covenanters were doing. They were going to endeavor to see that this was carried out, that there would be a transmission of this peace and this concern for peace from generation to generation. That meant that the nations, the kingdoms, would have to be aligned with the true religion, and that they needed to remain in a league, a constant league of mutual concern with one another. Fathers may dispose of the inheritance of their children, because that inheritance belongs to the father as well as to the son. But fathers have no more power to resign the liberties of their children than they do their own lives. You don't have a right to sell your children into perpetual bondage, which is what you're doing when you fail to bequeath them the best means for achieving peace. You are perpetuating that. No child has a right, any kind of absolute right in property, because in fact the children are property of their parents. And so the fathers have a right in the disposal of property, but they don't have that kind of right in the disposal of rights and liberties. Because when the fathers are dead, their property, their holding of property, vanishes. They didn't have a right to use that time in holding a property to prejudice the future rights of their children and their children's children. One of the most effective ways of endeavoring that this peace be maintained is instructing the posterity in the ways of the Lord. Look at Isaiah 54:13.
Isaiah 54:13. And all thy children shall be taught of the Lord, and great shall be the peace of thy children.
All thy children shall be taught of the Lord. Why is this such an important thing? Because what this is an establishing of God's right in His people. And God's right in His people is, in fact, a promise of peace to His people. He speaks peace to His people. That peace carries with it an obligation to the true religion. So back to that proposition here in this article, that in order to maintain this peace and the blessing that comes from it, there is at the center of it, there has to be a concern for the true religion. As noted before, this entails a careful instruction in these covenants and to cause the children to make conscience thereof. Deuteronomy 6, 6 and 7.
Deuteronomy 6, verses 6 and 7. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up.
What are you to do? Well, if they want this peace to go to all posterity, again, what they're doing is they're commending this covenant to posterity. They're taking this covenant not only for themselves, but for their posterity. They're commending it to them because, again, as we've talked about before with respect to covenanting and also just with respect to baptism, which is the sign and seal of the covenant of grace, it's necessary for the children to come to a point where they are going to own this obligation voluntarily. They're going to take it upon themselves, knowing that they have to make conscience themselves to keep covenant with God. You know, they have a promise of peace. They have a right to peace in the covenant. But that entails them eventually owning that, voluntarily obliging themselves to all that that entails. Again, this is why it's important that we instruct one generation after another in the principles of the true religion. And without such diligent instruction of our children and good examples given by us to them, God may justly plague us and let them forget and fall from this covenant, and the judgments of God will fall on the posterity, as on Israel, for King Saul's breaking of the oath to the Gibeonites. Look at 2 Samuel 21:1.
2 Samuel 21:1. And there was a famine in the days of David 3 years, year after year. And David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered, "It is for Saul and for his bloody house, because he slew the Gibeonites."
It's for Saul and for his bloody house. He slew the Gibeonites. What's the issue? They forgot the covenant. The covenant had been made, and it was not, the knowledge of it was not transmitted. Did that alleviate responsibility? No. God still held them responsible, even though they had no memory. They had to go back and root around and try to figure out what went wrong. And to inquire of God, why is this happening? Covenanters want to avoid this in the Solemn League. They're spelling it out, what they're doing, why they're doing it, and they're telling their posterity that they are not only doing it for themselves, but for them. They're not trying to do something that's only going to benefit themselves. In fact, in a society which is functioning according to those principles, blessings tend to accrue and grow from generation to generation rather than subside. It's like anything that you do, if you do it diligently in social or civil affairs. You know, the blessings of diligence in any endeavor tend to grow from generation to generation if everyone perseveres in it, if people aren't squandering it. The same goes with covenanting. The covenant is a way Not only are you binding them, you're binding your posterity and yourself together, but it provides a way of spelling out, making clear what you were endeavoring to do, why you were endeavoring to do it. We don't have to ask ourselves, what were they really up to? They're telling us what they were up to, what they were concerned to do, why they were concerned that it continue. Their attitude was not a very common attitude today, which is, you see it on the bumper sticker, I'm out spending my children's inheritance. They didn't view life that way. They weren't self-centered that way. They understood that they were, in fact, the beginning of, or they should endeavor to become, the beginning of a progressively expanding blessing. And that means they see it as not only a continual and broadening of the establishing of the Reformed faith, but the blessings, the peace that would accrue, that would come from that, would also expand. Now, everybody benefits from a society where you don't have a lot of crime, for example. Everybody benefits from being able to trust one another at a very low level. You know, this idea of praying that we have a magistrate that's going to allow us to live in all godliness and honesty. You know, if we want to live in honesty, then we have to have just weights and measures. We have to have a concern on the part of the magistrate to see that the duties that men have between themselves are enforced. But that'll never cut it. That'll never go all the way. It'll never fulfill its whole purpose if there isn't, along with that, a concern that men are fulfilling their duties to God. That's what the covenant is saying. Remember, it's a solemn league and covenant. As much as it's a civil league, it's also a religious covenant. They don't see the two things as being wildly apart. They see the one as necessary to the other. And they see the end of it all as not only their immediate society, but the societies around them, the nations around them, the kingdoms around them. They're the center of a peace that's spreading. You know, from England, you've got peace going out. They want to take, in fact, they want to take this solemn league to other nations. It was proposed to the Dutch. The Dutch never got around to it because they had just gone through that 30 years war I mentioned earlier. And there wasn't a resolve, a political resolve to engage. But they certainly understood that they wanted to spread this. And if it had spread to Holland, the likelihood is it would have gone out from there into other countries in Europe that were reformed and would have been pushing outward. So they understood the Solemn League and Covenant as being an international attempt to broker a peace, and that ultimately that peace was going to be rooted in a religious uniformity. Right, the fourth question. Should we seek that justice be done to those who are willful opposers to such a covenanted unity? Well, the answer is yes. We want to look at Ezra 7, 25 and 26.
Ezra 7, verses 25 and 26. And thou, Ezra, after the wisdom of thy God that is in thine hand, set magistrates and judges, which may judge all the people that are beyond the river, all such as know the laws of thy God, and teach ye them that know them not. And whosoever will not do the law of thy God, and the law of the king, let judgment be executed speedily upon him, whether it be unto death, or to banishment, or to confiscation of goods, or to imprisonment.
Remember, it's the purpose of a civil magistrate to see that there is peace in a society. That's only going to happen if there is a religious basis for it. So their concern for covenanted unity here is a concern for a religiously based peace. The people of the nations are going to be joined together. There's going to be an endeavoring to instruct, to see that people are taught the true religion, that they're brought out of superstition. What do you do when you have people, you're trying to do this, you have people who are standing up and saying, no, not me. We're not talking about people who are confused or people who are even negligent. They're talking here about people who are willful opposers. You know, we're talking about the people who are out there marching with their picket signs now, you know, the the activists. Those are the people that are in view here. And in Ezra's day, they understood that those people that were going to stand in the way of reform needed to be dealt with civilly. Confiscation of goods, banishment, and even death. Depends on the severity of the crime. And crime it is. Because what people who are willful opposers are doing is they are denying peace to an entire nation. We execute criminals on that very basis to this day. We incarcerate and we execute. Why? Because we call these people that we're incarcerating or executing menaces to society. If we understand that the real purpose of the government is to bring about peace and to establish a unity and peace, and we understand that can only happen through the true religion, people who are willfully opposing this, in fact, are enemies of the nation. They're enemies of the common people. They're enemies of all who are not resisting the truth. Right, the execution of justice is a matter of great rejoicing for a righteous people, but a slackness in punishing evildoers harms the morale of God's people. Look at Proverbs 29:2.
Proverbs 29, verse 2. When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice, but when the wicked bear the rule, the people mourn.
The people mourn. When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. Why? They rejoice because they're going to get that peace that they seek. They're going to have that impartial justice present in that society, which is lacking. But it's not going to happen apart from religious reform. It's not going to happen apart from some kind of religious endeavor. It's imperative then that justice be done, that others beholding their example learn to fear to do evil. Deuteronomy 13, 9 to 11.
Deuteronomy 13, verses 9 through 11. Thou shalt surely kill him. Thine hand shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. And thou shalt stone him with stones that he die, because he hath sought to thrust thee away from the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. And all Israel shall hear and fear, and shall do no more any such wickedness as this is among you.
So justice does and has this effect. When justice is meted out, that is, when it's meted out in a timely fashion, because delayed justice is injustice, when it's dealt in a timely fashion, it has the effect of causing other people who might be on the edge to recognize that this is not the course I want to take. It's not probably the direction I want to go in my life. When there is not condign punishment, when there isn't a following through, a certain number of people are tempted. And this number of people will grow depending on consistency of punishment. But they're tempted to see how far they can push the boundary, how far they can go in that limit. When you start pushing back, when the government starts pushing back and punishes people who are in breach of the commands of God, the number of people willing to push that boundary begins to decline. You know, the more they normalize any kind of perverse behavior or ungodly actions, the more people will become open and vocal in their support of it. Conversely, when they're openly opposing and there are penalties affixed, there are not only going to be less people who are going to be openly advocating, but there are also going to be a number of people who are vocally opposed. So what they're doing or not doing has an effect. And that effect has a direct bearing on the peaceableness of a society. The punishment of crimes committed is designed to terrify and so to prevent the repetition. Look at
Romans 13:3. The rules are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same.
Yeah, they're supposed to be a terror to those who are doing wrong, to the evil. It's their job. So willful opposers of covenanted unity, covenanted uniformity, these people are, in fact, in being willful opposers, they're actually proponents of turmoil and turbulence in society. They are warlike in their demeanor. And it's the duty of the rulers to suppress that kind of behavior. To put those kind of people, people who are stubborn, people who are recalcitrant, willful opposers, need to be themselves opposed with equal or greater force. They need to be pushed back. Right? When those who are exalted to places of trust and power, instead of putting laws in execution against vice and injustice and punishing the wicked according to their merits, they patronize and protect them, they give them countenance and support their reputation by their example, well then, we shouldn't be surprised. Wickedness proliferates. The wicked swarm in all places. They go up and down seeking to deceive, debauch, and destroy others. They're neither afraid nor ashamed to discover themselves. They declare their sin as Sodom, and there's none to check or control them. Look at Psalm 12:8.
Psalm 12:8. The wicked walk on every side when the vilest men are exalted.
There is, in fact, such a thing as a moral example. Not only the punishment, but the example. When there's accountancy, when people say, oh, it doesn't really matter what these politicians do in their private lives or what they do, it becomes a matter of public record. It does. And it also matters whether or not they're defiant or they're repentant. They're setting an example. You know, if they're defiant in their rebellion to God, they're setting an example of that. It's bad when they they have failings that are, in fact, causes for mourning and for repentance among the people of God. But we're always going to have that. You know, we're dealing with people who are sinners by nature. The problem is when that becomes an enshrined principle. When they think that they ought not only not to apologize, but even defend it. Worse yet, when they're doing certain things and they're not only defending it in themselves, but they are defending it in others. They create fields of influence. They create opinion. They're opinion makers. They move a population. They're leaders. They are leaders. You know, when the president says, I think this is immoral, or I don't think this is immoral, there are a lot of people who are swayed by that. When a world leader takes a moral position, right or wrong, there are a number of people who are moved by that. As I said before, if they were much more careful to take a proper moral position, more people would be affected by it because more people would be compelled by it. Because deep down inside, they know what's right and what's wrong. The fact is that they are examples, that they are moving a nation. They're moving the opinion of a nation. They're moving people in a direction. Now, people don't think it's important what the morality of public officials are. Those people have no idea of what is actually going on when it comes to leadership in the civil realm. People who wrote and subscribed to Psalm, League, and Covenant have a very, very different view. They understand, they believe and understand it to be extremely, extremely important what the leaders of a nation believe and the course that they pursue in enforcing that belief. They don't want these ideas dismissed. They want everybody to understand our happiness as a kingdom, each one, England, Scotland, Ireland, our happiness is predicated upon our adherence to the true religion. Our happiness is predicated upon not departing from the true God. Our happiness is predicated upon reform, not deform. Our happiness is predicated upon enforcing and upholding godly rules and laws and encouraging civil or public godliness and not encouraging vice and wickedness, debauchery. They would never have accepted a number of the principles that are now accepted in public discourse that would try to separate the public and private life of civil leaders and give them a pass or allow them to speak to something when they had lost any kind of moral credence. Just wouldn't have happened. They had a very definite sense of right and wrong, and they had ways of not only deposing but restoring people in terms of that. They didn't simply allow people to continue to spin out of control and become more and more egregiously and publicly wicked and debauched. So the last question then that we have with regard to this fifth article. Should we thus endeavor, according to our places and interests, that is, should we endeavor to pursue this kind of religious unity and uniformity, the peace that comes from it? And the answer is yes. We want to look at Deuteronomy 29, verses 9 to 11.
Deuteronomy 29, verses 9 through 11. Keep therefore the words of this covenant and do them, that ye may prosper in all that ye do. Ye stand this day, all of you, before the Lord your God, your captains of your tribes, your elders and your officers, with all the men of Israel, your little ones, your wives, and the stranger that is in thy camp, from the hewer of thy wood unto the drawer of thy water.
They understood that the peace, civil peace, the religious peace, and so on, that they're pressing, is in fact going to be the responsibility of everybody in the society. But your responsibility grows with your place and station in life. You know, if you're a child, you have one responsibility. If you're a parent, you've got a greater responsibility. If you hold some kind of ecclesial or political office, your responsibility again grows. You can't put everyone on the same level when it comes to responsibility, but at the same time, it's also a mistake to think it's only the responsibility of the people at the top. Everyone, they're saying, is in this together. Everyone has an obligation. According to your place, according to your station, you need to look around you, you need to take an inventory of yourself and ask yourself, what can I do? What must I do? What is possible for me to do? It's incumbent upon each person to endeavor the maintenance of the cause of God's truth in accordance both with his station or place and interest in the matters contemplated. Look at 1 Peter 2:14.
Or unto governors and unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well.
Okay, so thus we can say ministers have to give themselves over to seeing it's upheld as to matters ecclesiastical. Magistrates in matters which are civil. Fathers in matters which are familial. There's no excuse, there's no way out, you're stuck. You know, your place and station are going to define your accountability and your responsibility. They understand that, they're pushing that, they believe that, they want you to understand that. It's a requirement that everybody is pulling together because peace is not the right of any individual alone, it's the right of all those who are members of the true religion, and it's a right to all who fall down and submit to Christ's rule and reign. If we want this right to grow, to be spread, then we need to see a spread of the true religion. We need to see people concerned about it who weren't previously. We need to see people moving forward, pushing and endeavoring in a direction. We need not to encourage or in any way countenance anything contrary to it. So the fifth article is about posterity and about carrying this peace that comes from professing the true religion to posterity. And in that, the fifth article really is the article that recognizes and makes very explicit the descending obligation. And it does so on moral grounds. Okay, next time we'll look at the sixth article, which is the last article before we wrap up the Solemn League and Covenant the following week.